Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 2nd, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me on the line from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner and Barry Stringfellow at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Andy Tomalonis from South Coast Today. Now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Patrick, the planned expansion of the Cape Cod Canal power plant is surrounded by a number of court cases, one of which is filed by an environmental group. The state's highest court has a role in this story. Tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, this is not uncomplicated, so bear with me a little bit. The Massachusetts Energy Facilities Siting Board, which is responsible for ensuring a reliable energy supply for the state with minimum impact on the environment and lowest possible cost, had approved this expansion by NRG Energy at the canal generating plant that's there in Sandwich on the Cape Cod Canal. They had approved that expansion in June, and essentially what this was adding another unit to the two units that already exist there. And by units, I mean these gas-fired turbines, essentially, that produce power using natural gas, generally speaking. And so they had approved that, but the Conservation Law Foundation, an environmental group that weighs in on a lot of environmental issues in the Northeast here, had appealed that decision in August, arguing that the Energy Facilities Siting Board hadn't taken into account a 2008 law called the Massachusetts Global Warming Solutions Act in its decision. That act was meant to basically reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state. And so they had appealed that. It had essentially gotten to the SJC, and the SJC has agreed now to put that hold on appeal, or a hold on that appeal, essentially waiting for two lower court cases to be decided. The Conservation Law Foundation, I think, was essentially asking for this because they're waiting for these two lower court cases to be decided. Those cases were based on a challenge of state regulations by essentially energy generators. These were kind of associations that are associated with companies like NRG. So the Conservation Law Foundation is saying, well, depending on how those cases are decided, our appeal of this other ruling by the Energy Facilities Siting Board may not be relevant anymore, may not be as important as it was. If essentially the lower courts decide against the energy generators, then in their appeal, then Conservation Law Foundation's concerns would be mollified. And if they decide for them, then, again, this appeal may be relevant. So a lot goes into this, but this is a plant that's on the Cape Cod Canal, and people are certainly interested. It also has implications for Sandwich, which would generate a lot of revenue.
Big money for Sandwich, yeah. Perhaps, yes.
And has over the years. They've been getting tax money from the plant in all its iterations over the years. I think this agreement that they have going forward based on this expansion has to do with payment in lieu of taxes, but it's millions of dollars to the town, essentially, that would be involved in this.
And the NRG is saying that the plant is necessary and that they are themselves scrupulous about their environmental regulations and paying attention to those.
Yeah, and relatively speaking, when you look at natural gas versus other forms of fossil fuel-based energy, oil, coal, it's hard to argue that it's not cleaner. At the same time, folks who are pushing for more renewable energy, and the plant has gone forward with a project to put a solar project out there on its property, but folks who are looking for more of the state's energy to come from renewable sources would argue that natural gas is not the cleanest way to go. You could do wind or solar or go in other directions, and that the canal generating plant is by far, according to one advocate for renewable energies, the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions on the Cape.
I want to look at another story here. Two people from Sandwich have started an online petition challenging the state's proposed regulations around marijuana, and it's getting some attention now.
Yes, it is. And certainly, obviously, this is an ongoing issue in terms of the regulation of medical marijuana, in terms of recreational marijuana. This petition was focused on some draft rules that came out from the Cannabis Control Commission. That's the state agency that's now responsible for regulating adult use of recreational marijuana in the state. I think they also have kind of taken over looking at medical marijuana facilities as well. But these two Sandwich residents, one's a former selectman and the other's the wife of a police officer, are part of a team that behind this petition, which is essentially saying that the regulations, draft regulations that came out from the Cannabis Control Commission and that are up for a series of hearings, including one scheduled for 9 to noon on Tuesday at Barnesville Town Hall in Hyannis here, those regulations aren't appropriate, and that they give too much power to industry, essentially the marijuana industry, and don't safeguard young people enough, and they have a series of issues that they raise with those regulations, and they're essentially calling for legislators to weigh in again on how these regulations are being drafted. But the way kind of laws work, and this is certainly somewhat unusual as far as these laws have moved forward, because they were maybe not unusual, but the scope of them is these were voter ballots that, mm-hmm. that moved these two laws in terms of medical marijuana and recreational marijuana forward. Those then went to the ballot after the recreational marijuana law was passed. Your listeners may remember it went back to legislators who kind of took another bite at it and recrafted those laws. But part of that recrafting was certainly to establish the Cannabis Control Commission and give the kind of more specific powers to regulate and to craft guidance and policy and rules to the Cannabis Control Commission. And that's generally how laws work. You decide on a law, and then the agencies decide on kind of the specifics as to how it will play out. Mm-hmm. Again, part of this petition is asking that legislators, lawmakers, come back in and weigh in again on this.
Certainly a lot of concern within communities around the arrival of marijuana in the communities, whether it's in medical dispensaries or recreational marijuana shops.
Yeah, and different towns are at different places. We have a list in today's paper of the towns that have taken action locally on either bans or moratoriums of recreational marijuana shops. That's not banning recreational marijuana use or possession within those towns, which is now legal. But they're taking different approaches to how you handle it. And certainly, you know, citizens are weighing in and, you know, have had a chance to weigh in at the ballot and will have a chance to weigh in at these various hearings on these draft regulations. Currently, the timetable calls for a final vote on the regulations by March 15th, opening of license applications by April 1st. That's, again, for recreational marijuana facilities, and awarding of licenses for those facilities in June. Retail sales to begin by July 1st. So it's a pretty aggressive timeline, although, again, in retrospect, looking at, you know, how this law has played out, nothing really happened fast with medical marijuana, which we still don't have a facility for that here on the Cape, nothing's really moved forward very quickly in terms of recreational, but we're getting closer to the point where both those types of facilities would be open locally.
I want to go right now to Sarah Brown, who is on the line with us from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, you have a story about the numbers of deer that were taken on the island in the last hunting season, but it's not just a story about the deer. It's also about reducing tick-borne illnesses.
Yeah, it really is here on the island because biologists and the people who are working on what is called in the Vineyard the Tick-Borne Illness Initiative, Reduction Initiative, have really focused in on reducing the number of deer on the island as a way to reduce the number of ticks and therefore tick illnesses. There's a lot of deer here on the Vineyard. There have been estimates at about 50 deer per square mile, or as many as 5,000 deer, and deer do play a role in the life cycle of ticks, so that's why they're focusing in on the deer. And so the efforts have been going on for a few years, and this year we just learned the state released their preliminary numbers for the harvest last year. And it's the highest here on the Vineyard in at least the last 16 years, which is the only data that I could find. Nearly 800 deer were taken during this hunting season. And I guess the harvest statewide was a new record high, too. So it was up everywhere, perhaps maybe because of the weather or other factors. But here on the Vineyard, I think that kind of bolstered what these ongoing efforts to increase the number of deer that are taken.
And as the deer are taken, they're testing them for tick. They're taking ticks off mm-hmm. them and testing those ticks.
Absolutely, yeah. They're, like you said, testing them for ticks, getting a lot of really information from the deer. Also, there are a few new programs that got underway this year. They're really just beginning, so it's hard to say if that had anything to do with the increased number, but that included a deer donation program. So the thought was that hunters might stop hunting at a certain point once they don't need the venison anymore. But if there's a way to donate it to people who might want it, that it might encourage hunters to take more deer. So this year, the Island Grown Initiative started a program to accept deer donations. They had a processing facility that could turn it into venison, and that was donated to the island food pantry. And about 260 pounds of venison, which is 5 deer, were donated this year. So not a huge number, but it was also only underway during the shotgun hunting season. So next year they're looking at expanding it to the whole season to maybe getting more venison to people who want it, but also, they said, to encourage people to take more deer. And we also just found out yesterday, actually, that one of the measures that's been talked about here on the Vineyard and elsewhere in southeastern Massachusetts has been expanding the hunting season. Mm-hmm. And that's been a topic of conversation here for the last year. And just yesterday I found out that the Fisheries and Wildlife Board is going to be holding a public hearing in March about expanding the archery season. So starting it, I think, 2 weeks early, and that's going to be March 7th as their public hearing. So that sounds like something that might, another initiative that might happen next year.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Patrick Cassidy with us on the line from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, I want to step ahead to a story about whales. Just at the end of the week, we got word of a dead right whale being reported, the first of 2018. This week, your reporter, Marianne Bragg, took kind of a close look at the history of this particular whale.
Yeah, and this whale is known as number 3893, but does have a lot of history, despite being only about 10 years old. When she was three, number 3893 survived an entanglement after rescuers cut away a rope and she got rid of the rest. But obviously, her luck ran out recently. And this is especially concerning for researchers and scientists and advocates for these animals who say she was just reaching reproductive age. And with a population of probably less than 450 at this point, every reproducing female is important. And certainly this one was one that people were upset about her dying. She was found January 22nd dead off the coast of Virginia. Preliminary findings seem to indicate that she died from chronic entanglement. So that entanglement, about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, was not the only one. They had seen her, though, up and down the East Atlantic coast about 90 times during her life, including in Cape Cod Bay as recently as last April and on July 29th of last year in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And that's relevant because some of these deaths have been occurring around here on Cape Cod and up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and this kind of big number of deaths from last year, a number of them occurred in Canadian waters. So again, Marianne Bragg, who's been covering the whales for us and this issue for us, was looking at the history of this whale. And it really speaks to kind of the whole species in some ways, because her father had died and was among one of the 12 North Atlantic right whales that were killed in the Gulf of St. Lawrence last year. And her brother, at the age of one, had died as a result of entanglement. And presumably this is all done using kind of DNA, and they're able to track individuals within this population because there are so few of them. And they are so visible when they're able to see them from the air and on the water. But again, it's a big deal to lose any one of these North Atlantic right whales, with the population kind of headed toward, as a lot of researchers have said, the seemingly inevitable extinction is what they're saying could happen in the next 40 years, unless something really, really drastic changes as far as how humans interact with these animals. A lot of this is coming from entanglement or ship strikes. Mm-hmm. But again, when you have a population that small, you have a lot of concern whenever even one whale dies.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And with us on the phone right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hiya, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, Chatham is considering a zoning bylaw change to try to create more housing. And this has some fierce opposition who say it's a step in the wrong direction.
Indeed. The planning board has proposed what they call an accessory dwelling unit bylaw, which would essentially allow people to add an apartment or a guest house to their property for rental. Now, the planning board has proposed this measure as a way to sort of get at the shortage of housing in town for people who make, say, between $70,000 and $100,000. That, you know, it's too much to qualify for affordable housing program, but really not enough to afford the high cost of buying a home here. And the idea is that a homeowner would add a rental apartment or a guest house to their property by eliminating one of their own bedrooms, with the stipulation that the unit be rented for at least 6 months of the year to prevent them from becoming seasonal rentals, which people would charge a lot more for. Now, the town currently has a similar bylaw, but it requires that the units be deed restricted as affordable. And under that program, there's been no units created. So they're trying to sort of free that up a little bit. But critics at this week's selectmen's meeting said that there are too few controls in the measure, and they say it will double the number. It could potentially double the number of housing units in town, which would be significant. One critic called it the perhaps the worst zoning proposal they've ever heard. Another said it was the most unwanted social experiment in Chatham's history. So there's some vehement opposition to this.
Hmm.
Other people said, you know, there's no incentive for homeowners to rent at an affordable rate. And so the measure wouldn't help the problem, essentially. It would just create more market rate units. Now, selectmen were a little less critical. They're saying, you know, basically we have to start somewhere to encourage more attainable housing in town. They basically put a placeholder on the warrant for the annual town meeting for the article. And they sent the measure back to the planning board for some more work. And the planning board is going to gather more public input at a public hearing they're going to have on February 27th.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for that.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, we were just speaking about right whales. I want to talk about a different species of whale in the news this week. Minke whales coming under closer scrutiny after a number of strandings last year.
Yes, and certainly not the same level of concern in many respects with the minke whales. These are fairly common whales. I think there's about, you know, 3,000 of them known to kind of go up and down the East Coast here, and they're certainly in other locations. And they're whales that you kind of see out there more frequently. Some people may mistake them for their larger cousins, but they're considered the, kind of the smallest of the great whales. But there have been a number of strandings over the last year. Again, 29 minke whales in total stranded, you know, up and down 12 states since mid-January, and there were 8 in Massachusetts, 5 on Cape Cod. And actually, on Cape Cod, that was one of the only ones that was actually kind of saved and that was gotten back out to sea and actually tagged. And this was somewhat unusual because they were able to follow its wanderings after it left here. But like with the right whales and also with humpback whales, which there were, I think, 62 strandings of humpback whales over the past year or so, they are also considered to be under an unusual mortality event, and that's a designation by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that basically allows more money and more resources to be put towards an investigation of these deaths. There's some overlap in terms of the types of things that have happened to these different types of whales, but there hasn't been anything kind of definitively pointed to that kind of crosses all three whales that are considered under this unusual mortality event designation. But again, you know, they're a whale that a lot of people, a type of whale that a lot of people around the Cape, if they're out on boats, will see more frequently than the right whales or the humpbacks, because they're kind of these smaller whales that are kind of more they're around more, and there are more of them, certainly.
Let's speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, good morning.
Good morning.
Josh, the agenda for the upcoming town meeting looks like it's quite full. Tell us about this.
It is definitely quite full, but at least there's 2 months before the April 3rd town meeting, the Tuesday after Easter, to digest it and to get familiar with it. And we'll do our best over here at the Inquirer and Mirror to help the voters do that. There are 90 articles on this year's annual town meeting warrant. That's actually a little bit less than there tends to be at Nantucket's town meeting, so not too bad. There are also no really, really big ticket items, depending on how you define that. Like in the past couple of years, we've had municipal sewer extensions, new town nursing homes, but there is a number of spending requests from the town on there, including $15 million for traffic improvements on Old South Road, which is the major corridor that leads from the middle of the island out to the airport, $2.5 million to renovate the downtown marine department, a number of citizens' requests as well. One would seek to waive the sewer connection fees for year-round residents connecting to the new sewer system. Another to ban the further construction of an affordable housing project on town-owned land that's already moving forward. There's also a move to change the name of the Board of Selectmen to a more gender-neutral name, the Select Board. So a lot going on.
And in terms of things that the top dollar things that people are going to be concerned about?
The $15 million for the road improvements, that's the top one. There's, like I said, there's a number in the $3 to $5 million range. There's a $2.3 million for the final construction plan design of a new Department of Public Works building. The town had initially talked about seeking funding for the entire project, which was estimated to cost at about $18.5 million, but decided to seek engineered final plans first in the hope that that price tag might come down. There's also about $3.5 million for stormwater management improvements. So there's a number of spending items on here that would also require approval at the ballot box if they are approved at town meeting on April 3rd.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy with us from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, the State of the Union this week on Tuesday. Your reporter Cynthia McCormick had a nice profile of a Cape-born and raised soldier who got to attend, in particular to highlight an important issue.
Well, and to highlight, an ongoing controversy that's at the national level, and that's why the State of the Union was involved here. Patricia King joined the military right after getting out of Cape Cod Regional Technical High School in Harwich, and along the way, as Cindy wrote, she made history. She became the King, that is, became the first infantryman in the U.S. Army to come out as transgender. Which she said made her the first enlisted female member of the infantry. She became also the first active duty service member to have the military pay for gender reassignment surgery. And certainly this has been in the news. As it happens, Donald Trump had issued essentially an order and had kind of rescinded or tried to rescind a policy that the Obama administration had put into place that allowed transgender soldiers. A court has, since overruled that intention, and the Trump administration is supposed to come out with something else to address the issue from its standpoint. But again, King's presence at the State of the Union address this week at the invite of U.S. Representative Joseph Kennedy III, who gave the official response to the State of the Union from Fall River here in Massachusetts. Her presence there was obviously something that sent a message, certainly from folks who are supportive of transgender rights and certainly of the rights of transgender people to serve in the military. So there is, as you said, a nice profile on King and her journey, and folks can read more about it at CapeCodTimes.com.
Ed Miller is joining us right now from the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Medical marijuana is coming closer to Wellfleet, and it seems like this week you saw more indications of that. Tell us what's happening.
Yes. Well, the selectmen in Wellfleet have written a letter of support to a company called Atlantic Medicinal Partners, which is hoping to open up a medical marijuana dispensary on Route 6 in South Wellfleet on a piece of land those of you who are familiar with Wellfleet, it's next door to Van Rensselaer's restaurant. It's the site of a foundation that was put in about 12 years ago for a planned storage facility that never got built. And it's been sitting there very forlornly for more than a decade. And now it looks as if it may become a marijuana dispensary.
And go ahead.
As you know, we have two approved dispensaries coming into the town of Provincetown, which I think so far are the only ones approved anywhere on the Cape. The Wellfleet one will be coming before selectmen probably in the next month to approve a community proposed host community agreement. Many of the towns on the Cape, as I think you mentioned earlier in today's show, have actually passed moratoriums or bans on marijuana dispensaries. But Wellfleet is one of the towns that voted pretty enthusiastically in favor of marijuana in the 2016 ballot question. About 65% of voters in Wellfleet voted yes. The only town that was more enthusiastic, I think, was Provincetown at, I believe, 76%.
What has to remain now as this is getting closer? What remains to be done?
Well, there's a few things. Obviously, there are some questions just about the location that may come up. It is within the designated marijuana dispensary overlay district that was approved as part of the town zoning bylaws. The current bylaw in Wellfleet specifies that marijuana dispensaries can be established only by nonprofit entities. And the company, AMP, right now is set up as a nonprofit, but they are planning to convert to a for-profit in order to be positioned to also sell recreational marijuana when that becomes possible under state law. And so it's going to require a change in Wellfleet's zoning bylaw. And the town administrator, Dan Hort, told us this week that there's going to be an article at the next town meeting in April asking the town to change that provision in the bylaw to make it allowable for a for-profit company to sell marijuana here. And so if that doesn't pass, then it's not clear what would happen to this particular proposal. So we'll wait and see what happens there.
Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Thank you, Ed.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times with us. Patrick, story out today about a local store hosting a hunting competition for coyotes. I didn't even know that there was a legal hunting season on coyotes in Massachusetts. I learned this reading the article.
It is true. And just before we go on, just to correct one thing, I think there's a Mashpee medical marijuana facility that's going to be opening sooner than the Provincetown facilities. And I may have lost the thread on whether Ed was talking about recreational or medical, but in this case, I think Mashpee, as we're going to be reporting
lined up,
both
yeah.
days, is going to have a medical marijuana facility open. But back to the coyote hunt that you were talking about. Yes, this is something that's raised the hackles for activists who are concerned about the way these hunts take place. And hunters are saying that this is something that they do with some ethical underpinnings. The coyote hunt is being sponsored by Powderhorn Outfitters here in Hyannis. And coyote hunting is perfectly legal. We talked to a state official who said that between October 14th and March 8th, excluding Sundays, you can be hunting coyotes in Massachusetts from dawn until midnight. And turn in this is that this is a contest essentially to see who can bring in the largest coyote or the most weight in terms of cumulative weight of coyotes, and you get prizes for doing that. And it caused a stir on social media again among activists who contend that the sport's not humane and that this contest in particular is not humane and kind of they don't see the purpose in hunting coyotes. I don't know if these same activists feel the same way about deer, but they, I think, would contend that there's a difference in terms of what's the use of a coyote or a deer after it's killed. But again, hunters, you know, say that this is something that they do, and it's something that they do ethically, and they wouldn't do something that was inhumane in terms of when they're out there. And they say you can't really understand what it's like to be out hunting unless you go out and do it. We did, just for the record, try and get in touch with anybody who was participating in coyote hunters to see if we could go out with them and kind of have that experience and see what it was like out there. But nobody took us up on that offer, and Powderhorn, you know, declined to comment on the contest. But again, it's legal. The contest does go a little longer than the season, and there's a reason for that, which I think has to do with you have 4 days to kind of come in with your coyote, the carcasses, to show them what you've caught. So it's not that they'll be hunting after the season. It's just that that's how long they have to show what they've caught. But again, there are, you know, folks who are out there who are upset about this and have actually tried to take action at the federal level, asking the USDA to take a study out that they were using that they say was based on basically faulty data. But there will be hunters in the woods, and you know, would have been without this contest, but this just takes it to a new level as far as the activists are concerned.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Barry Stringfellow at the Martha's Vineyard Times.
There's more in a moment.
Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And with us on the phone right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is Barry Stringfellow. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Steve.
Barry, you've got coverage of an immigration story that began on the vineyard and is being decided in the Supreme Court. It's a bit complicated. Explain this for us.
It's very complicated, but I'll do my best. The Supreme Court on January 12th agreed to hear the case involving Wesley Fonseca Pereira, who is facing deportation to his native Brazil. And at issue is how a deportation order is given and what constitutes a stop in an immigrant's 10 years of continuous physical presence in the country. And under federal law, if a non-registered alien remains in the country for 10 consecutive years, he or she is not eligible to be removed. Records indicate that Pereira came to the island in June 2000 for a six-month period as a temporary non-immigrant visitor. According to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he failed to honor the terms and conditions of his admission remaining for years after its December 2000 expiration. Fast forward to May 2006, he was arrested and charged with OUI. While he was in custody, Department of Homeland Security issued a notice to appear for removal under the Immigration and Nationality Act. Now, his attorneys are arguing on one hand that he was not served proper notice because the document was sent to his street address in Oak Bluffs rather than his post office box. And this is something that happens on the island all the time. There's this, you know, black hole where mail ends up if it's not properly addressed. And most people do have post office boxes. So he did not get that order. And the court said it was on him to find out when the hearing was. It also said that his 10 years stay was interrupted by the arrest, and that he had not been in the country for 10 years. So they're arguing it on two fronts. He has two daughters that were born here, so they're also arguing that they would suffer hardship if he was deported. So that's where it stands. The Supreme Court, you know, hears about 100, 150 cases of more than 8,000 that it's asked to review. So we'll be watching it closely.
Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you for that, Barry.
You're welcome.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, town of Falmouth is taking a close look at the drawbacks and the benefits of artificial playing fields. And this is in advance of town meeting.
Yes, and they've been looking at this issue for a while. Certainly people in Falmouth who say that the fields there aren't up to snuff as far as being maintained or being safe to play on. have been looking for new fields and a way to make them safer. And they were looking at synthetic turf fields to start with. They actually took a proposal to town meeting last spring, asking for about $72,000 to cover engineering costs of a turf field as part of a $6.7 million capital proposal. But town meeting essentially said, well, we want to look at natural grass as well as turf. And so they went back to the drawing board more or less. And this field's task force and planning committee is focused on looking at three areas of comparison between turf and grass fields: impact of injury and recovery, environmental impacts, and player development and competitive opportunity. And so they talked about this at a public forum on Thursday. And there was a lot of back and forth on both sides, people who were concerned about the materials used in the turf fields and whether there's potential for that to leach into water. And this is basically a rubberized tire-type material. There was, contention that that material could be encapsulated, but concerns even about that process. Other people raised concerns about, injuries that take place on grass fields when those fields aren't maintained and you have divots and other things that players can step in and really get in trouble and have injuries from. So again, the town's looking at, kind of a major revamp of their fields and making sure that they're safe. This discussion will go on. And again, they're looking to bring something before a town meeting in April that can be voted on and kind of move forward with this at this point.
Andy Tomolonas joins us right now from the South Coast today. Andy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Andy, a local environmental group is filing a suit against the town of Marion for its sewage treatment. This probably isn't what folks think of when they think about Marion.
No, it's not. And it is one of the wealthier communities in the state. But it's had this sewage stored in lagoons for a number of years. And the Buzzards Bay Coalition has been trying to stop that and correct it. What happens is they've got this three lagoons. They're unlined. They cover more than 20 acres. And they're leaking up to 50,000 gallons of wastewater, in a day. So it's a pretty serious problem. The wastewater has nitrogen. The nitrogen can pollute the bay and cause algae growth, and that hurts the shellfish. It kills the eelgrass. So it's a pretty big environmental problem. The coalition's attorney, Corin Peterson, told us that it was surprising that the town would still hold its wastewater in this way, in the unlined pits. There have been these things in other towns, and more than 15 years ago, there were two towns in the area, Wareham and West Falmouth. They closed their lagoons or they outfitted them with liners to prevent sewage from leaking out. And the coalition has been, like I say, the coalition has been, monitoring this for a while. And the U.S. EPA was going to force the town to line all of its lagoons. But that's a very expensive project, even for, a wealthy town. So the town has only a population of less than $5,000. So it would put a lot of burden on, each individual user. So the town appealed to the EPA. And they were granted a compromise. And now what they're going to do or planning to do is to line one of the lagoons and then try to limit the use of the other two lagoons. So that's not really good enough for the coalition, which wants to eliminate the leaks. And so there's the lawsuit that was filed.
Andy Tomolonas from SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, thanks for catching us up on that.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times with us. Patrick, a pair of stories this week touching on a new performing arts center for Hyannis. And I want to start with the plan for Barnstable to expand a special growth incentive zone in Hyannis and have some residents, this plan has some residents very upset. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is kind of the yin and yang of this story. This Hyannis Growth Incentive Zone is an agreement between the town and the Cape Cod Commission to essentially streamline economic development and investment opportunities within the area. It's a large chunk of Hyannis. And as part of the renewal of that zone, it has to be reviewed and renewed from time to time. They were looking to expand it to include an area On the kind of west side of town, that's currently the location of the resort and conference center down there, and also the Twin Brooks Golf Course properties. And the, one of the reasons for this, or the real reason for this, is that the Oceanside Performing Arts Center, which was announced as this plan to open up a facility that would have the Cape Cod Symphony as its anchor tenant, and but also have other things going on there, and that was announced in 2016. And the idea was this was going to be the location for that. So in discussions with the owner of the property, it was looked at as an area that should be included in this expansion. But residents in that area have come out to, there was a planning board meeting on Monday. I think it came up at the town council meeting last night as well. And they came out and essentially said that it was something that they had major concerns about, whether it's traffic and other things that could result from this facility or from this designation within this growth incentive zone. So again, it's the town's got to decide pretty quickly on what to do with that area, they have to do that before the renewal is due on that area. But at the same time, again, the Oceanside Performing Arts Center, which was announced a couple of years ago, hasn't really come forward with any definitive plans as far as what is going to take place there and what they're planning to put in that area. We actually did get them on the phone this week, and they did outline at least one thing that wasn't included in those plans, which was that the Cape Conservatory, which is currently located at a West Barnstable campus and a Falmouth campus, but the West Barnstable campus in particular would come and be part of this new facility down in Hyannis. And so they outlined a little bit more about their plans, but they're still very much in the early stages. They're looking for an architect to help them design this facility still and kind of move forward with it.
And they're envisioning it there as they say, as kind of a mini Tanglewood. Is that right?
Yes, and again, that's the idea. I think when it was originally announced, I think I was at the announcement, and they were talking about kind of being able to open it up to the ocean on, like, open up the back side of it, and I'm not sure how specific they've gotten as far as designs there. But a place for the symphony, and again, this idea of having a place for the Cape Cod Symphony and a performing arts center in Hyannis has been a long discussion. When they opened the Performing Arts Center at the Barnstable High School, that was thought to kind of fill that role. But they've always been talking about having kind of their own space and not kind of kind of resting there at the high school. And I think at the high school, they've also, seen a lot of interest in using that space for other things. And so there seems to be appetite for it. But again, residents in that area where it's supposed to go in have a lot of concerns about the changes that would take place and say that this expansion should not go forward. Some of them said, we're in favor of renewing the growth incentive zone, but we don't want to renew it with the expansion. But again, it was heard before town council last night, and the kind of decision was continued, so they'll be talking about it more before making a final decision on whether that expansion takes place.
Patrick, moving to another story, Harwich selectmen wrestling this week with decisions around the Monomoy Regional Schools and enrollment there.
Yeah, and obviously both towns, Harwich and Chatham, which are part of the Monomoy Regional School District, have to wrestle with this. But there's been concerns about enrollment, specifically at Chatham Elementary School, and a decline taking place there, and a disparity that's then occurred between the kindergarten class sizes in the two towns. And they've even taken some action. Chatham reduced kindergarten classes from 3 to 2 to increase the class size, but it still has smaller class sizes in every grade than Harwich does. So they're looking at this, and they're trying to figure out how to address this. Whenever you have this joint situation, as in Dennis Yarmouth or Chatham Harwich, in this case, you have a regional agreement that the towns have entered into. And the regional agreement in Chatham and Harwich requires that students from each town go to their respective elementary schools unless they get a special permission. They're now looking at whether or not they can kind of streamline that process in terms of allowing students to go from one town to the other to kind of even out the class sizes. But to change the regional agreement and make that happen, It would have to go through, you know, a two-year process, more or less, go before the school committee, selectmen, town meeting, would need state approval before it was allowed. So this proposal, which was approved by, again, the Harwich selectmen Monday night, requires only a majority vote by the school committee, the regional school committee, and majority votes by the Harwich and Chatham selectmen. There would be no town meeting or state approval required. Somewhat ironically, in order to get this change to the regional agreement passed, however, it seems that it has to pass both boards of selectmen, get town meeting, and get state approval
and the state,
so that they could
yes.
change it going forward.
Another story this week, the company Vineyard Wind continues to face concerns over a proposal to run a transmission power cable through Lewis Bay.
Yeah, I like to say just when you thought it was safe to build a wind farm again. obviously, this is not Cape Wind. This is one of three projects that are being pursued further offshore south of Martha's Vineyard. In this case, it's Vineyard Wind. The other two projects have their transmission lines coming ashore in other locations. Vineyard Wind has been looking at a route for its transmission line similar to the one that Cape Wind had proposed when it was looking to build a wind farm in Nantucket Sound, which would come in Yarmouth, go through Yarmouth to the town of Barnstable to a switching station in Barnstable and connect into the grid there. There have been concerns raised by residents about this, and the Yarmouth Board of Selectmen voted unanimously on Tuesday to send a letter to the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs detailing its concerns about the cable and asking that the company, Vineyard Wind, be required to take certain precautions if the project does go forward. Board of Selectmen says they're not taking a stance one way or the other on the project at this point, but they're just asking for these kind of stipulations to be considered and to be included if the cable, the transmission cable, that is built. Interesting enough, at the same time, or almost simultaneously, Vineyard Wind has withdrawn a host agreement request to the town, which would, you know, address various concerns of the town, but would also, you know, set in kind of motion how the two interact, the town and the company. They say they're doing that because they've heard a lot of these concerns, and they feel that it would be kind of a waste of time to move forward with the host agreement that they had originally proposed, and they want to kind of rework it and try and take into account a lot of these concerns. A lot of them have to do with the impact on Lewis Bay, which is where the cable would go through. I know the town of Barnstable has other concerns that have to do with the where it connects into the electric grid and any concerns of spills of chemicals or other things that might end up in the town's drinking water. So even, you know, a cable to just plug in a wind farm, you know, meets certain concerns and would certainly have to meet certain environmental criteria. And it seems like Yarmouth, in any case, has raised some of those concerns here and will presumably continue to do so as this project moves forward.
And another story from this week, well, these days, what doesn't have a touch of politics to it, turns out even the cause of great white sharks. You have not one but two articles out this week about this story. It started off with some revelations about President Trump's supposed bias against sharks.
Well, and thank you, Steve, for letting me talk about how a porn star, Stormy Daniels, in this case.
I'm giving this story to you to explain, yes.
Exactly. Led to a discussion about great white sharks on here on Cape Cod. As a lot of people will know, Wall Street Journal reported last month that this Ms. Daniels, her real name is Stephanie Clifford, had been paid $130,000 by Trump's President Donald Trump's attorney before the 2016 election to be quiet about an alleged affair the two had. And she's denied this, but there's been some equivocation even as recently as this week after the State of the Union. But in any case, that helped resurface this earlier interview with her where she talked about them being together and about them watching a Shark Week and about his comments about how he doesn't like sharks and that he won't, you know, contribute to charities that help sharks and that he, you know, this is a quote of her quoting him, hopes all sharks die. So that coming out caused a lot of people to turn around and look for shark conservation groups who they could donate to. One of those is here on the Cape, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, said they got about 50 donors who responded in the past week for about $2,000 in total. some with checks with Trump's name written on them. And this was obviously something that they were responding to and responding to those comments. And during that initial conversation that we had with the president of that group, Cynthia Wigren, she said nobody's donated the $2,500 that's required to get a shark named. And she was thinking about somebody potentially wanting to name a shark after Donald Trump. Well, a gentleman did come forward. He didn't want to name it after Donald Trump. He actually asked that it be named after Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who is looking into, as again, all your listeners will know at this point, any potential collusion or alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia or Russian officials. So when they're able to tag this shark, it will be bearing the name of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And this gentleman who wanted to remain anonymous said it was just a humorous jab, and he hoped people took it for what it was.
Thank you, Patrick, for laying that out for us. Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.